there is a land. A place in space-time, light years away. Where the best in progressive music of all types, rock, metal, electronic, and more, come together. It's time for you to take a journey to that magical realm where galaxies collide, the strangest of creatures lurk and slither, and rituals are enacted to bring about the dawning of a new age!
Well, enthusiasm is encouraged, but control is needed. This is Progtopia, episode 132. And warm greetings to all of you in the land of Progtopia. Welcome to the program that features interviews, reviews, and discussions about both well-known and up-and-coming acts in Prague, which is a term we sometimes define loosely and proudly so. My name is Mark Ashby. I'm the host of the show. Join us now for a trip through the wires, and hopefully you'll come out the other side ready to subscribe to the program and follow it on Facebook and Twitter. Visit progtopia.com for past episodes and hear what you may have missed. For now, though, we press onward. I'm going to stay close to home again with this show's featured band, and I'm also going with a more indie acoustic kind of sound for those of you who are into that sort of thing. For you folks who like it a little heavier, I've got you covered later on, but I hope you'll all listen to this interview with a Baltimore-based duo named Water Planet. Millie Landrum and James Hesser make a pretty full sound with their vocals and mostly acoustic guitars and percussion, with appropriate use of synthesizers when called for. And their album Ghost Hypnotic is a great showcase of tunes that manage to be simultaneously challenging and hummable. That ain't easy. While they've played plenty of gigs in the New York to Maryland corridor of the Mid-Atlantic, they're embarking on a more comprehensive tour through other parts of the country in the month of July, which you'll hear about shortly. We also talk about what sorts of influences led them to their style, how their jobs as teachers inform their lyricism, and why most of their songs are written by one or the other of them alone. I actually used to work at the same company as Millie close to 20 years ago, although we'd lost touch since then, until that wonderful thing called Facebook jogged our memories and brought us back together, I don't know, a couple years ago. So I hope you enjoy what follows as much as I enjoyed catching up with them a bit. So join me, won't you please? Don't try this at home. Build a ramp, jump a canyon. Stay strong. All right, well, why don't you describe Water Planet's sound and general vibe for us? What do you guys like?
I mean, both of us, I would say, are influenced by like 60s pop type stuff, but also by punk. So it's an odd infusion. We both write songs, and we both write in really different ways. There's one song on our most recent CD that's a collaboration in terms of the writing, but most of the time we write separately. And then because there are two of us over the years, in terms of the way things are arranged, we've had to really adapt because we're trying to cover a lot of different bases with instrumentation. So so there's a lot of times when like vocal lines will sort of do what an instrument might do if we had more people in our band. So a lot of the arranging is kind of working that out and also working with both male and female voices. James has a really deep voice. So, depending on how you're using it. But that's something that we've worked with a lot is initially trying to keep things from being too mid-rangey in terms of sound, and then later on sort of trying to find ways to fill out the bass end because we don't have a bass player. Anyway, it adapts as it goes. James, what would you add?
So that describes a lot of our work there. I'm not sure how it gets our vibe as a band.
Yeah.
Our vibe as a band, I mean, I think we definitely have that. there's a 60s influence, pop and psychedelia, no question.
Yeah, psychedelia. Definitely
sort of the more moody side of like 80s post-punk and all is a big play in what we do too, I think. But a lot of people sort of throw us in these sort of psych folk type of thing too, because we come at it with acoustic guitars and like congas and percussion and all. So it's got its own thing. I mean, we've gotten all kinds of comparisons all across the board. And it's always kind of fun to see what people say, but I don't know that anybody's landed on any one thing for us yet, which is cool, I guess, but also can sometimes make it tricky. People are like, well, where do you guys fit? It's like, well, we fit where we do.
But, right, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
That's
yeah.
kind of what the idea of this show is. I always say it's, you know, progressive sort of music, but I think you can get boxed in by that prog label as much as anything else. So I usually just prefer to talk to people who are doing something that just sounds interesting.
That's what we've always been going for, just really trying to do something that, while we've got all these influences, really isn't like anybody else is doing. So,
right. You know. We kind of feel that if something's been done before, it's great, but we really are more interested in exploration, and that's the impetus for what, you know, that drives what we do.
Perfect. All right. Well, you mentioned that you have some of these sort of broad influences. Are there any specific artists or bands that you take your influence from?
I think when we initially started working together, we sort of came together through a mutual love of the band Bauhaus.
Weird.
But at the
I
same
hear that.
Time, like,
I definitely hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then.
That's true, though.
Yeah, there were a lot of other areas that overlapped. We actually found when we started working together that we knew we had mutual friends but hadn't known each other. You know, for years we had mutual friends and didn't know each other. Mm. So the influences were all kind of in the same kind of pool. But like when I was in high school, I was probably most into the Beatles. And I studied classical piano, so like I had the classical music training, but not in any of the instruments that I ended up playing in this band. But, you know, like listened to a lot of 60s psychedelia and stuff like that, and then got into punk in college and post-punk and new wave and all that stuff.
I had everything from the classic rock stuff. I mean, I had a strange love for Blue Oyster Cult growing up, which is its own thing. Really liked a lot of the early Pink Floyd stuff, but... Okay. A lot of the 80s, like just the new stuff that happened that I honestly, because I was living in a rather, not small town in its own sense, but the radio options up by me in Philadelphia, I was living outside Philly, there really wasn't a lot unless you knew how to connect to it. So a lot of like the early 80s post-punk stuff that was going on, I didn't really catch on to until later in the 80s, but once I did, it really had a big impact on me too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like Bauhaus and all those guys, but... you know, Joy Division, early Depeche Mode stuff, definitely those
P.I.L.
kind of things. P.I.L., no question.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. God, even like, well, no, that wouldn't fit that time period. But, I mean, later, then you get into things like Meat Puppets and Pixies and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a huge Breeders fan, always have been. They're much later, but, you know, jumping around time periods here. Mm-hmm. But,
your bio on your website says you're primarily a duo. So that, what is that primarily implying?
So we've had people in and out of the band for four or five different people in four or five different sets
throughout the whole history of the band.
Yeah,
actually.
And it's just because of the nature of life and schedules and commitments and all those type of things. Keeping one person that was able to really stay in and be a part of it was just, it just hasn't happened yet. So, but we've collaborated with different people. We've had people in for, you know, doing shows with us, doing some recording with us, and it's been great. You know, it just hasn't worked out where we've been able to really have that extra person who's become a permanent thing.
Right. Yeah. And when I first started doing this band, before this, I was always in bands with four or five people. And as you get to, you know, further into your career and adult life and all that stuff, it's harder and harder to get coordinate schedules of five people, and almost impossible after a while.
Yeah.
And get people to who really want to do something but may not immediately see a monetary return for what they're doing, which happens a lot in music. So so getting people to commit to a project where, you know, you've got a certain vision, they have to really be on board, and after a point they start wanting to, you know, have more reason to be there. So anyway, that's the way it's been.
Saying, we're not into that. Remind me later. We're getting updates here. The other thing that's kind of funny about that, since you mentioned it, is that technically I came in as a third person. It was actually Millie and another person when I first joined the band, and he left not long after. He was a mutual friend. And we really sort of stuck around and became the band after that. And sort of so, yeah, it's kind of been like duo, trio. Once or twice we had four people in.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much it, yeah.
Yeah, but I would say in terms of consistency, the whole time the band has been acoustic guitar and percussion.
Yep.
That's with other things added in now and again. We're starting to work a little more with some electronics being added in to flesh out the sound. Which really started mostly when we were recording several years ago, and we kept adding in electronic bass lines to things so that the sound would be, you'd have that depth. You know, right now, that's always been a thing that we've tried to add, I guess, that's not there.
So we might hear some slightly less, well, I don't want to say slightly less acoustic, because I think that'll always be there, but maybe some more experimentation on that electronic kind of front, maybe sometime down the road.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, although I play acoustic guitars, I've always sort of played with a bunch of different effects on it.
Yeah, that's true.
Play through, you know, I usually Crybaby and some other stuff in there, delay, and you know, just give it a little extra texture, play a little more grit, and I'll get into that, you know, more experimentation.
Yeah, and before I did this band, I was in bands where I was primarily a keyboard player, and I still have this this Roland Juno 106. And when I was younger, I used to do, you know, there were some things that I did more structured piano style playing, but most of the time I liked playing with noise. So I think some of that tendency is starting to come back into this band with both of us. We've both been exploring a lot recently with that the last, I guess, 2 years or so.
It's a lot of textural stuff and things to just sort of keep a little drive to things and mix it up a bit.
So,
Yeah. It looks to me, and you've already kind of touched on it, that the writing credits on Ghost Hypnotic, the full-length album there, it seems like you each kind of do your own songs, and then, you know, then it kind of becomes like, you know, okay, well, Millie's doing these and James is doing these, and then you come together with it. Is there a reason why it tends to be kind of like a solo writing thing for you guys?
You're looking at me, so I'll do it. Okay, so, I mean, traditionally, yes, and I think Millie hit it right in that first question where it bounced around a lot, but the only song that we've actually written completely together almost from day one was Sea Shanty, which is on it's the second to last song on Ghost Hypnotic. All the other ones we've always just approached, and I think mainly because when we first came together, we had been writing songs on our own anyway and had sort of our own way of approaching writing, and it was fairly unique, but we were both able to listen and sort of compliment what the other person was doing, and that become more of a support structure that way and an editing structure. But in terms of the writing process, you know, Millie's a writer by trade, and I have always been sort of a creative writer in my own regard. And, you know, I think it's just always been something we've done on our own, but it's been fun. Like as I said, Sea Shanty, writing that together was, we actually really liked it. And one of our favorite songs on the record, which is cool. But, yeah, it's just been how we approach it, I guess.
Yeah, I think also both of us have really idiosyncratic writing processes, so we write really differently, but then when we put it together as a band, I think it makes a fairly cohesive sound. But I think also as we've worked together, that's kind of knitted together more over time. I think at one point it would have been easier to say, that's definitely a James song or that's definitely a Millie song. And now I think there's more. We also really both work on the arranging constantly together, always suggesting things to the other. And so, you know,
yeah,
a lot of times you'll have
definitely a team effort always.
A lot of times you'll have an idea in your head of what you want it to sound like, and then you present that to the other person. They may or may not do that, but they'll come up with something else that works to fill whatever needs to be filled there. So,
through the barbed wire, you're under fire. Don't look up, look out. Eyes wide open, you're done hoping for deliverance from a cloud. A cloud.
The lyrics, I mean, you talk about being a writer and that, and I kind of want to touch on that since you mentioned it. Are there any literary influences that you guys have in particular? Because the lyrics really do drive the music in this kind of a setting, you know, when it's pretty stripped down, unplugged kind of sounding, the lyrics really have to stand out. So I just wonder, like, what do you read? What do you take inspiration from in that regard?
Actually, for graduate school, I went to Johns Hopkins writing seminars. And so I studied with some fairly well-known writers doing fiction writing and have ended up doing other stuff with my career just to make a living. So I initially wanted to be a writer, novelist, poet, that kind of thing. And so, you
still
know,
do it,
but I think, yeah, I still work at it. I can't say that's where I make my money. So anyway, I do it. I mostly teach at this point. But I mean, when I read, I would say most of the people that I read at this point, unless it's something I'm preparing to teach, and I teach, you know, like classic writers, I would say, I tend to read nonfiction a lot. I like history and I like, just spiritual books I enjoy reading. Supernatural. I read a lot of cheesy ghost stories and stuff. So I don't know. But writing style-wise, I started more as a poet, moved into fiction, and then always I wrote songs. I started writing songs when I was in early high school, I guess, maybe late middle school. So, you know, I don't know. Those two things evolved together.
I don't know, for some reason, Moby Dick has been a book that I just keep coming back to. Always been a big one for me. Siddhartha is a huge one.
Mm-hmm. I teach that, so I reread it all the time.
I mean, Shelley, Byron, poet-wise, but there's so many poets that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even know where to even start with that. But a lot, honestly, I come at it a lot from a visual art standpoint, too, because I'm a visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even there's songs on the album where I'm just, you know, rattling off colors and things. And a lot of it's imagistic for me. That's always how I've sort of, like... there's a song years ago, Smokescreen, on our previous record that a lot of it was just inspired by sitting by a pond and looking at what's happening under the surface of the water and how it's interacting with the sky reflecting in it and how that sort of triggers all the things going on in your brain. There's a lot of different influences.
Mm-hmm.
It makes this kind of a thing where it feels like this is the perfect music that you can listen to. Well, I think of like two different sorts of settings when I listen to this music. It's either like chilling at an outdoor summer music festival or just like in the park or something like that, or you're at a coffee bar in a university town, you know. And that's the kind of when I think, like, you know, I'd be reading a book in these kind of places too.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, that's cool.
Is that your kind of, speaking of that sort of thing, I mean, you guys play live somewhat, and we'll get to you know, a little more of that in a bit here, but I mean, what kind of places do you usually play whenever you're out live?
We have played a weird gamut of things, and we get, because nobody can figure out what genre we play, really, then we get booked with all kinds of people. Like, we've been booked with burlesque acts. We have been booked
like
with
cabaret, which fits what we do in some places.
Screamo hardcore bands, spoken word, hip-hop. I mean, you name it, we have played with it. And so it's been, I forget what the question was. What was the rest
of your kind of places?
Yeah, the kind of places that you play. Like, or I mean,
we've met a lot of really cool people. The one thing I'm noticing is, like, what we do, I find we're fitting a little more easily into the indie rock mode these days that people are doing. There's a lot of duos out there and a lot of sort of this acoustic crossover harmonic approach to things that I think works with what we do quite a bit. So it's nice we're starting to see, you know, sort of bills and things where we feel like we fit in a little easier.
That's true.
Mostly clubs, mostly smaller clubs, things like that. We have played some outdoor festivals. Actually, a couple weekends from now, we're actually next weekend, we're playing at an outdoor brewery in Hampstead, Maryland, which is cool. And we played there once before. That's a lot of fun.
It's called Rollman's.
Yeah, Rollman's Brewery. But most of it's been on the, you know, the more local club thing, some sort of DIY spaces here and there, basement shows, house shows, you know, but most of it's been, go ahead.
The last several years we also played, we've been playing up in New York a fair
bit,
Harlem and in Brooklyn. Not so much this year, but
we
are doing another show on this tour up at Pianos in Manhattan, which we've never played before.
Yeah, that's
But it tends to be like smaller club type places.
We have played some coffee houses, but it's been a while since we've done those, actually.
We used to do music conferences when we were, you know, starting out, did some showcases at those.
Well, you say, I heard the word tour in there. We need to talk about this tour. Water Planet is heading out on the road here in July. So how about letting everyone know where they'll be able to see you perform?
Okay, cool. Next Friday, the 6th, we're starting off at Reverb Collective in Baltimore, which is on Charles Street. It's a very cool, intimate space. That's going to be a lot of fun, actually. Looking forward to that. And then the day after is that Rollman's Brewery show. And then why don't you continue from there?
Where okay. Are we going? I should get the list and be concerned.
Yeah, but we're so the short version is we're sort of making a loop that's going up through Pennsylvania and circling down through the Midwest and then some southern dates and then sort of back up through Philly and New York. So it's kind of nice getting this nice little loop of a lot of cities we haven't been before. So yeah, we're where are we at? Pittsburgh after Saturday on the 11th. At Arsenal Bowl, and then...
Yeah, that's a bowling alley. It should be a lot of fun. I should be looking forward to it.
Then we're at Mulligan's Pub in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the 13th. Moe's Tavern in Chicago on the 14th. Melody Inn in Indianapolis, Indiana on the 15th. And then we have a little drive time going to Nashville, a place called The Back Corner. Then Athens, Georgia, something called Flicker Bar and Theater.
Yeah, which I think is a movie theater. That should be pretty fun, too.
That looks pretty cool. On Pop of the World Studios, which I think is more of a collective space in Greensboro, North Carolina. A place called The Local in Boone, North Carolina. And then Bourbon and Branch in Philly. And Pianos in New York, which is on the 25th of July, which is sort of the last
finishes things up.
Yeah, nice little loop.
Yeah, nice little three-week kind of jaunt there. And
a lot of places we haven't, like areas of the country we haven't played before.
Yeah, so that's... I was wondering why that was, you know, like you guys seem like you're moving a little further afield here because, you know, it seems like most of the shows were, you know, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, Delaware, that kind of corridor. So what prompted this move to try to branch out a little further west there?
I mean, well, we recorded the album Ghost Hypnotic at the tail end of 2016 with Matt Leffler-Schulman at Mobtown Studios. And that was awesome. We'd been dying to get in the studio for a while. We'd been writing a lot and playing a lot, actually, but then hadn't had a chance to really record and really wanted to get, you know, working with somebody else to have a little of that influence and all
right,
that, too.
Right, because we usually record ourselves.
So having him engineering and creative input and all was just, it was awesome and good stuff. Mm-hmm. But then right after that, we did a little radio promotion with it and all, and had planned to do a lot more touring, but it was one of these things where life sort of smacked you around a bit. And just a lot of complications came up that we just couldn't get out and do the promotion we wanted. So we did what we could, but really had made plans to get out and do a tour and just started working on that this past year and getting it booked up. So, you know, it's really summertime's work really well for us because we're both educators, so we both teach. And that's the only time we can really take a nice lump of time to really go out and do it. So it worked out nicely to get that going this summer.
That's cool. Does this mean you're trying to make some more moves to maybe get some attention from various labels or other corners or anything? Are you seeing anybody like that on this tour or hoping to see?
Hoping, certainly. we're certainly welcome any of that. Any kind of being a duo means you're also two people doing everything, which, you know, that's a lot. It's a whole lot. And certainly any kind of extra support we could get, we're always hoping to do that, no question. Don't have any concrete, definite, you know, communications or plans that way at this moment, but hoping that maybe all this exposure will help open up some more doors and maybe make some more connections. Definitely. Sure.
Is there any new music you haven't recorded that you might be playing on this tour?
Definitely that we haven't recorded and that hasn't been out in a while. We've both been writing things, but yeah, it's possible. Actually hoping to do some writing on tour, too, because I've got a lot
that's our objective.
It's one of these things where we'll have a lot of time just together traveling around, downtime between shows and all, too. And I know I have a lot of ideas spilling around, and I know Millie said she does, too. Mm-hmm. So hoping to actually come back with a whole set of songs that we can get back into recording on, too. So.
Yeah, we also both, because we've written a lot for, you know, over a period of time, we both have a lot of songs that never got recorded that are still in the repertoire of stuff that we play. So some of those we'll probably try to get to. Actually, on Ghost Hypnotic, there are a couple of older songs on that. That
just never got recorded.
Yeah, that we just never had a chance to record, but we always played live. So Under the Rug is one of those songs. Something Somebody Said is older.
Yeah, and a lot of it, too, was just playing with arrangements. We've had things for a while and just a lot of times because, you know, one person comes to the band with a song and they may have a thing in their head, but between the two of us, we hadn't quite figured out what to do with it as a performance or a recording piece yet. And
right.
then over time, they just work themselves out, you know. So
well, and sometimes you there are a number of my songs that I've tried various ways to approach them playing out, and you play them out, and they either – that's the nice thing about having audiences. They either work or they don't work, and it's pretty obvious. So so that feedback is crucial.
Yeah.
So anyway, some of these have finally – come to a place where we know how to arrange them, and then they're ready to be recorded.
Back to the rest of the interview in a moment, but here's one of those songs that tends to be a crowd pleaser, according to them. Have a listen to Something Somebody Said.
At night when Wendy takes a walk, the buildings call her name. And if she doesn't choose to talk,
conversations she has tuned into her head. Get in the car and drive.
Must have been something somebody said.
Just get in and drive.
Don't bother to look her up. She doesn't act the same.
Communicates by telescope transmitting. Calling out your name. Get in the car and drive.
Must have been something somebody said.
Just get in and drive.
Don't bother to look her up. She doesn't act the same.
Communicates by telescope transmitting into space.
Well, why don't we give people a website where they can find you and definitely get the music? It's always about moving the product on this show. So,
gotcha.
Let's direct people.
Most cases, you'll find us under Water Planet Band. So our website is waterplanetband.com. On Facebook, it's also Water Planet Band. Bandcamp also. And I believe that's also the case on SoundCloud and most of our other Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff. You can definitely pick up digital download on Bandcamp. You can also get it through CD Baby. And we'll definitely be bringing CDs and all that out on tour with us too. So of course, any of the shows is a great place to pick it up, and got a lot of extra fun stuff there. But yeah.
Extra fun stuff. Water Planet keychains, Water Planet flamethrower, Water Planet
flamethrower.
Yeah. Spaceballs
next
here.
Next tour, the flamethrower.
We're working with Tesla on that. We're excited about doing this. This is the first time doing a big tour like this where it's a really consistent string of dates scattered around. So it's going to be a new experience. It'll be fun. We're looking forward to that a lot.
Yeah. Curious to be playing for different kinds of audiences and seeing how it works other places.
And a lot of these cities.
We did get some of the bookings were based on where we got airplay when we did the radio promotion. So I'm hoping that that means that we actually have people there who are excited to see what we're doing.
Yeah.
We don't know till we get there.
Millie and James of Water Planet. They're from my nearby stomping grounds of Balmer. That's Baltimore if you don't live around there. These guys are quirky. They're indie. It's acoustic-y. They don't really, have a label, which is good for people listening to this show. And I really like the experimental vibe. So I hope everybody who's listening is going to check them out either on a recording of theirs like Ghost Hypnotic, or, hey, if you're anywhere near those places they mentioned on tour in July, go see them if you have a chance, or do both. That's the best of all. So, guys, thanks a lot for being on the show. Hope you have a great tour. Enjoy it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Red, yellow, green, blue, act like you're see-through. Man, woman, bird, bee, swim in the same sea. Every desert was once a beach. Dried up and spent, but not deceased. Just breathe.
Okay, waterplanetband.com. Make sure you go there. You can find out a lot about their tour there, I believe, and at their Facebook page. So make sure that you check them out. If you like that sort of indie rock with a twist kind of thing, I think that's something you're going to enjoy going out and seeing. Okay, I thought for this next segment, I would do something that hasn't been done on this show before, but seems to be a thing that is becoming a YouTube sensation lately, and even more further in the past. They do these reaction videos, and they can be to anything, like funny things, gross things. But I've noticed that there's been a lot of music-related reaction videos lately. Like, specifically, there have been some things being shared related to Marillion. And if you listen to this show, you know that I like Marillion a lot. And these people reacting to the first time hearing some Marillion albums. And it's interesting enough that I thought, well, I wonder if I can do something like that. And if there's an album that I have never heard or even heard any songs from and don't really know a whole lot about that could be considered progressive that I should listen to. And especially if it's a controversial kind of album, like one that maybe didn't get a whole lot of good sales or good critical acclaim, then maybe I could do that and see what I think of it, just kind of in real time, record it that way. So the one that kind of came to mind, it just sort of went past on one of the progressive rock forums that I follow on Facebook. People were talking about the Kiss album, Music from the Elder, which was released in 1981. It had really bad sales. Fans generally didn't seem to like it much, but it had sort of a progressive element to it, certainly more than a band like Kiss was known for. And if I'm going to go back in my history some, I don't know if this is something I've ever mentioned on this show, but Kiss was really the first band that I was ever kind of obsessed with. And this came at the ripe age of 5 years old. Because I was born in 1973, summer of 1973, and in the summer of, or in the winter of 1978, the albums, the solo albums that all the members of Kiss did, you've probably seen them where you just have their face on the cover with a black background and kind of looks like it's backlit in a different color, like Gene Simmons was red and Paul Stanley was purple, I believe. Those albums. Well, with that, and the double platinum compilation, double vinyl album. My uncle, who was a fairly young guy himself at the time, and he liked Kiss, he knew that I was kind of interested in them from seeing them on TV. Well, he gave me all of those albums for Christmas, all five of them.
And boy, did I play them to death. Those things, I still have them in my collection. I wound up playing definitely the Ace Frehley one the most. I still love that album to this day. Probably Gene was second. But they kind of take me back. Every time I think of Kiss, I think, like, this was the first band that I just loved. I couldn't get enough of. I even saw The Phantom of the Park. Yes, I look back on it now, and, you know, that was just the most ridiculous thing ever. But anyway, I thought, you know, I was never really aware of this album, Music from the Elder, because it came out in 1981. I had kind of moved on by then. I was listening to more just like pop stuff on the radio by then. Bands like Styx I had started to listen to. And so I had kind of gone away from Kiss. And I really didn't know anything about this album until somebody brought it up on this forum on Facebook. And I thought, huh, I should check that album out. And I hadn't done it yet, and that's when I got the idea for this reaction video kind of thing, although it's going to be audio on here. So what I'm going to do, I promise, I have not heard even the songs that are, you know, semi-well-known from this. I know there's one called A World Without Heroes. If I've heard it before, I certainly don't remember it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play the entire 42-minute, 46-second album here. I'm not going to make you listen to my reactions during the entire thing, but I'm going to edit down some snippets from what the full album is, and maybe I'll like it, maybe I won't. I have no idea. This is supposed to be like the Kiss prog rock album. So without further ado, I am going to dig right into Music from the Elder by Kiss. Let's see what I think. Okay, we kick things off with Fanfare. Well, this orchestral stuff is certainly kind of proggy. I can see why Kiss fans probably put this on their turntables and said, what the hell am I listening to? Don't quite know what to make of that sort of opening. It's certainly not Kiss. It's dramatic, I guess. Let's move on to Just a Boy. Okay, the story begins here. Kiss goes Canterbury scene? I don't know what this is. This is like the Hobbit bothering we always have fun with. You know, it's not bad, it's just, it's not what I expect from Kiss. Well, with that falsetto, you certainly don't sound like a man. Okay, one song in, I don't hate it. Yet, we'll see. All right, now we've got Odyssey. Good God, I can understand why Kiss fans absolutely hated this. I understand why there was no promotion. They were getting in on prog rock when prog rock was dying. But, like, here's the thing. If you don't know that this is Kiss, although I don't know how you can miss it with Paul Stanley's voice like this, if you're a prog fan, this is not out of the realm of what you're used to listening to. It's like this was supposed to be a big old stage show, like a musical or something like that. Feels like we're in some sort of realm of the Vikings here. Don't quite know if that's what they were going for. I haven't read up on it a whole lot, like I said. But that's the way I feel about it at the moment. So far, it's a solid B. I don't love it, but I really I feel like I still want to listen. All right, next up is Only You. This sounds like it's a little more rockin'. good Gene, Kurt sounds like. Say what you want about Gene Simmons. Yeah, he's an asshole, but I preferred his vocal style to Paul Stanley's, so I like the fact that they're able to use the fact that they've got these different singers in the band to create the different characters, just kind of like you do in prog rock a lot of times, huh? Ask Arion about that. Okay, this feels like the first thing that's approaching a proper Kiss song on this album. It's got that sort of a rockin' back beat. Yeah, when I think of Kiss, Only You is the kind of song that I think of. I realize they're also going for this is a chapter in the story. But, yeah, I get it. I get this song. Okay, we segue nicely into Under the Rose. Do you think Eric Carr, since this was his first album with them, do you think he was like, okay, I guess I'm getting paid? Didn't know I was going to be doing this. I thought I was going to be playing rock and roll all night and having groupies in the dressing rooms all night long. Oh, holy cow. We've got a nice little, one of those big sounding chorus group sing events here. Sounds very Viking and powerful and manly. I want to see chest hair whenever I hear this song. I feel it growing off of me right now. I will say that the story element of this, I got to take off points for it not being horribly original, and the lyrics are not all that creative. It's not like, you know, big vocabulary like you often find from the prog bands that we know and love. Thinking of, you know, like the Pete Sinfield, King Crimson type of things, even though they weren't really concept albums. But it just seems like it's a typical, like, you know, they even have it as the title of one of their songs there, Odyssey. You know, this is just a quest of some sort, and there's a prophecy, there's, you know, someone young, he doesn't think he can handle this yet, or something like that. I'm a little underwhelmed by that element of it, but then again, that's never stopped me before from some concept albums. There's simple stories in a lot of them, or at least less than comprehensible ones that you're kind of like, well, I just listened to that, I have no idea what it was. So, I mean, I can follow this. It just feels like it would have been maybe even better if there was a little more involved lyrics to it, but I don't expect that from Kiss, to be quite honest. All right, looks like the next song that's going to be coming up is called Dark Light, which is very proggy in its sense of using an oxymoron as the title. Hey, Ace, how you doing? Okay, I take back what I said about some of the bigger words being in there. Ace, I love you, but you were never the strongest singer out of this group. Ace Frehley had said that this was not a good idea to release this album. That's what he said later. That at the time, he was like, look, guys, I don't think we should do this. So the fact that he participated in what sounds like some of the writing of this, I don't know, it's encouraging to me. He was always my favorite instrumentalist, even if he wasn't my favorite singer out of the band. So I don't know if it fits in with the rest of it, though. This seems kind of like just Ace's own song just kind of grafted on into this. It's a decent song. Again, you just kind of take the vocals graded on a curve. I gotta be honest, it sounds like he's not really even trying with the vocals on this. So, I don't know. It's a little disappointing in that sense, but it's an okay song. I still stand by my B for this album so far, and I think we're about halfway through it. Oh, wait a minute. I do kind of remember this song.
I think I just didn't really associate it with anything. But kind of a curious choice for the single. I guess I understand. But it's not a Kiss kind of single. Certainly is giving Gene Simmons a chance to kind of croon a little bit. I have to say, it's easily 30 years since I've heard this song. And it's a product of its time. This definitely sounds like that early 1980s post-disco sort of semi-soft rock kind of thing. I mean, it's certainly no Sailing or Arthur's Theme. I mean, Christopher Cross certainly has that market cornered. It's all right, though. All right, how about The Oath? So while this rather normal-sounding Kiss song is playing, I decided I'd look up the wiki about this album just for some things. And I'm reading that because the Unmasked album, which came not long before Music from the Elder came out, that was kind of a pop record compared to what they had done before. They and the management kind of thought they wanted to return to a harder rock sound, but Simmons, Stanley, and creative manager Bill Alcoin felt that just returning to a harder sound was not enough. They believed that only a bold artistic statement would regenerate public interest in Kiss. And that's how they got Bob Ezrin involved and the American Symphony Orchestra and the choir. Haven't heard any choir really yet, so that'll be interesting. Well, I'll give them an A for effort in the sense of trying to make a bold artistic statement. I don't think that was really what Kiss was designed to be, though. Kiss was always designed to be just sort of this fun, just, you know, kabuki kind of rock band that got all the girls and had their mysterious image, at least for another year or so. They didn't take the makeup off. So I guess I'm just a little confused why they thought this was the direction they had to go. Prog rock was certainly dying by this point, supposedly. I mean, we all know that it did come back later, but I mean, if you look at what was going on in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, with prog rock, they were all kind of moving to pop. I mean, that's what Genesis did. That's what Yes wound up doing only a little bit after this. So for Kiss to decide that this was that direction, I'm a little confused, guys. Okay, what's up now? This one is called Mr. Blackwell. Of course, Mr. Blackwell is Gene Simmons. Yes, Gene, we know you love sinning, buddy. I am fully aware of that. Don't drink, don't smoke, don't do drugs or any of that. But boy, that one other sin you really like is good, huh? Actually, there's two of the seven deadly sins I can think of with you. Who the hell is this Mr. Blackwell? Like, it doesn't seem to fit in with the rest of this. Like, this was all Vikings and hobbits and crap, and now Mr. Blackwell sounds like he's some dude on the corner of a, you know, rundown side street in New York or something. I don't know. I don't mean to crap on the album because I actually, you know, we're most of the way through it now. We're, what, 9 tracks out of 11 or 12? Yeah, 11 tracks. And I mean, this is better than I was expecting, to be quite honest. This has made it onto some, like, you know, what were they thinking lists from, you know, those websites that come and go where they all talk about, like, they try to sound like they were, you know, so ahead of the curve, like, hipstery, like, you know, oh, well, I knew that was crap before anybody else did. Or conversely, you could have it on some of the best lists of, like, you know, this was
this will be much higher regarded than it is by the fan base and by other people in general. I mean, it's all right. That's what I can say about it so far. I'm not going to say it's total shit. It's not. It's got some really good moments. I will say the first half has held up better than the second half. Now we're into the instrumental track Escape from the Island. So, obviously, the boy has got to escape from Mr. Blackwell and whatever it was that he was doing and sinning. Kind of don't want to know. We're talking Gene Simmons here, after all. Good little instrumental track, but certainly not anything like Fractured Mirror off Ace Frehley's solo album. All right, we're going to round things out with I, as in the letter I, as in the pronoun I. Apparently this was also released as a single in some places, or at least the B-side of something. Looks to me like they couldn't make up their mind what song they wanted to release, so they released a whole bunch of different ones in different countries. Because The Oath was released in some places. World Without Heroes obviously was. And then this one. This is the single. If they were going after the rock sound again, like they apparently they were, they didn't want to be like pop sounding. This was a way better song to release than World Without Heroes. World Without Heroes just sounded like something that should have been on Gene's solo album, where he also, let's not forget, put a really awful version of When You Wish Upon a Star. This feels like, you know, 1977 vintage Kiss here. I realize this is only 4 years later, but supposedly they had, according to Q Magazine, lost the plot by this point. This song sounds like they got the plot back a bit. I would have released this song 100% over any of the other ones. Feels like something you could hear in a stadium. You know, this audience can start chanting along with that. I. Real positive message. I believe in me. Hey, stay in school, stay off the drugs, folks. Well, I believe in you guys too. I gotta say, I believe in this album. I wish that more people would give it a chance. I mean, if you don't already have a connection to Kiss, I guess you might not enjoy it as much. Like, if you go into this expecting a Thick as a Brick or something like that, you're not going to get that. It's certainly not that. But for Kiss, this is a bit of a stretching of their capabilities as far as content, that kind of thing. So I dig it. You know, I think if we were playing the give it a spin or throw it in the bin game on the Prog Squad with this one, I would have said give this one a spin. I'm impressed enough that, yeah, I will say the beginning of it was stronger, kind of like a lot of albums just sort of dipped in the middle, but I ends it really good. And that's the Kiss kind of quintessential sort of Kiss song to me. Is it, you know, worthy being played on the radio now more than something like, you know, Cold Gin or Strutter or something like that? Yeah, probably not. I can understand why it isn't. Ain't a bad album, though, folks. So if you haven't heard Kiss's music from The Elder, and if you like some of that, you know, schlocky 70s rock along with your prog, like I sometimes do, I think this one is worth your time. Okay? So that's my reaction audio for Kiss's music from The Elder. We'll see if this is something we want to do again. If you got an album that you think might be worthy of getting this treatment, we'll just have to find out if I've heard it or not. Maybe I'll do something like put some polls up on the Progtopia Facebook page. So if you want to participate in that and maybe come up with which one I'm going to listen to next if we decide to do this again, then you can vote in that as well. So thanks for being a part of it, and we are going to move on to a little bit of Haken kind of discussion here with one of our new contributors.
I had been talking off and on for a few months with Mark Nagy, the guy you're about to hear from, about possible contributions he might make to the show, and he mentioned to me recently that if he were king, is that a cockroach king, I wonder? He would reorder the tracks on an album much beloved by prog metal fans the world over, The Mountain by Haken. I'll leave it to Mark to explain his reasoning, but for those who aren't intimately familiar with the album, or if you are and you want to follow along, maybe go grab your copy of the CD or Google the lyrics. That could help you in your journey here. All right, Mark, take it away.
My name is Mark Nagy, and back when it was a thing, I was a writer for the power and progressive metal website Blackwood Metal. 5 years ago, I had the distinct pleasure of reviewing an album I was really excited to hear, Haken's third release from Inside Out Records, The Mountain. Like a lot of fans, I got on the bandwagon after the release of Visions and their show at Prog Power USA. I wasn't at the show, but we've all seen the Celestial Elixir video by now. Legendary. And like a lot of fans, I had braced myself for another eclectic but progressive metal album. And the first two singles, Atlas Stone and Pareidolia, didn't betray those expectations. In fact, for me, they set them much higher. By the time I got my promotional copy, I had already spun the singles into the ground, and so I did a kind of stupid thing, and I went immediately to hear the six songs I hadn't heard. And those songs were Cockroach King, In Memoriam, Because It's There, Falling Back to Earth, As Death Embraces, and Somebody. And if you think about just those six songs as a listening experience, Cockroach King, In Memoriam, Because It's There, Falling, Death Embraces, and Somebody, those are, you know, other than Memoriam and Falling, that skews real heavily towards the Gentle Giant-influenced, lighter, vocal-driven fare. Which they only kind of hinted at in the singles, just like those weird part, the more jazzy parts in Atlas. And so right off the bat, I was in a kind of a weird spot with my expectations and this album. Now, over the years, I've gotten over that part of it. Pareidolia is probably my favorite song from that record. I hesitate because it's real tight between that and Falling. But even looking at all eight songs, and I kind of lump the path in with Atlas, it doesn't feel like there's a particular rhyme or reason to the track list. We start out with this big anthemic number that's driven by percussive guitars, and then it kind of draws back to a mid-tempo, but we're really drenched in the stylistic aspects of the album with Cockroach. And then you turn the adrenaline way up, and then it just goes weird with Because It's There. You go back to heavy, and then you got the ballad, and then back to heavy, but weirder this time, and then you close on a ballad that turns bombastic. And I say it with those kind of descriptors, because if you think about Affinity, and you move just, you know, you flip Earthrise and the Architect and Red Giant and the Endless Knot in the track list, those descriptors fit The Mountain and Affinity perfectly. I think there actually is something of a formula they were sticking to there as far as how to stitch the album together when they went from Henschel writing everything to group writing. But I think, and I think that works for Affinity. I think it works really well, especially with how they did the through line between Initiate, the Architect, and the last song. But I think in the case of The Mountain, I think for an album called The Mountain, I guess with that cover artwork they have, which is gorgeous, and even just building from the musical moments that are already there, I think there's a more cohesive, more conceptual listening experience to be had if you reorder the songs. And not much. But what got me thinking on this line was Because It's There.
World, this child's we must.
And by all rights, that's an incredible song. It's probably the most ambitious song on the record. But when I first heard it, and even listening to it more recently, it just sticks out like a sore thumb when you put it in between In Memoriam and Falling Back to Earth. Those are two just absolute bruisers of progressive metal songs. And I get the notion of putting a breather in between them, and it kind of works live, but I don't think they should have done it on the album. What I think they should do with Because It's There instead is, because it references both Somebody and Cockroach King with its lyrics and kind of musical references, and just because of how it sounds, I think it makes sense as the closer. You put it after Pareidolia, because honestly, I don't love how much of a momentum drop there is after Pareidolia with the really long build-up in Somebody. So I think you put Because It's There after Pareidolia, and then you put Somebody first. You use it as like a character introduction to this person who in track two, which we're going to put as Cockroach King, is then seduced into this hollow ambition, which becomes the mountain. And in this new track list, you go Somebody into Cockroach King into basically the musical part of the path. You kind of cut out the ambience at the beginning. You go the path, Atlas Stone, then Atlas Stone into In Memoriam, and In Memoriam into Falling Back to Earth. And the reason you do it that way for the first half of the album is because now, other than, I guess, kind of the end of Cockroach into the Path, into Atlas Stone, and maybe some of the jazzier parts on Atlas, but like by and large, everything is heavier and faster than what comes before it. Somebody starts real slow, then you get a little, you kind of get bombastic by the end, but Cockroach King is kind of a step up from that. Atlas is a step up from that. In Memoriam is even more energetic than that. And then you get all the way up to that first half of Falling Back to Earth. And my favorite moment on the mountain is in Falling Back to Earth, right smack dab in the middle, when it goes and it releases all of that momentum. And you go down to the vocal driven and Mellotron passage. And in this arrangement of the album, that transition is not only the fulcrum of Falling Back to Earth, which it is, but it is now also the fulcrum of the entire album, because you have 35 minutes of build-up to that point. And I don't think it gets boring at any point, because I think all of the songs that are up there are good songs. They're honestly some of the album's best songs, and they're all... The Mountain is an incredible album. So there's no real way to get bored during it. But I think you have a more conceptual first half. And then by switching, you put a 4-minute song at the end and move one of those 9-minute songs to the beginning. You also have a slightly shorter ending after that. You've got As Death Embraces after Falling Back to Earth into Pareidolia. And I think that works really well. You don't mess with that. That's like a perfect... As Death Embraces is the perfect length. And then after Pareidolia, you've just got a 4-minute out reference the intro, reference Cockroach King. You've got some musical through lines and you're done. And, you know, as I said, you know, it's not the most radical change. It's all the same songs. But if you're into the full album listening experience and feel like maybe the mountain is a little wandery, and a lot of people I've talked to about it do feel that, you know, they love the music, but the order kind of wanders a bit. I don't know, maybe this will breathe a little bit more life into the listening experience of what is already one of the greatest progressive albums ever. Hope you enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know what? I think I'm going to organize a playlist of that album in the order he suggests and see what I think. In the meantime, maybe you can give us your thoughts on what Mark is proposing here. Or maybe you'd like to give some of your feedback about music from The Elder. Or anything else you've heard or want to suggest to me. It's all welcome on the Facebook page or on the Twitter feed or by email at info@progtopia.com. info@progtopia.com. That's the email. Let's hear from you. All right, it's time to get out of here, but before I do, my thanks again to Millie and James of Water Planet. Don't forget to go to waterplanetband.com. You can get info on how you can get their music, their tour dates, that's on their Facebook page, all of that. And to Mark Nagy for his insightful analysis of what is probably my favorite Haken album. Gave me something to think about. We've got plenty more coming your way in July and in the rest of the summer. So subscribe on iTunes and follow us on social media so you don't miss out. Here's a clip from Water Planet's Sea Shanty, which is subtitled If You Should Go, to play us out. Progtopia's theme music is from the Salvation Song Suite by Galahad on their album Beyond the Realms of Euphoria, used with permission. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time in a land called Progtopia. Progtopia.